You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
It was the year of fire.
The year of destruction.
The year we took back what was ours.
It was the year of rebirth.
The year of great sadness.
The year of pain. And the year of joy.
It was a new age.
It was the end of history.
It was the year everything changed.
The year is 2261.
The place, Babylon 5. The podcast is the Epsilon 3.
Right here on the ESO Network.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Okay, to get things started, you know, we're looking back on the last 7.5 years of Monster Attack. We've talked about a lot of films from the mid to late 50s, and we've got another one for you this evening. We've done a teenage werewolf, we've done a teenage Frankenstein, and we've done a teenage vampire in Blood of Dracula. But this will be a teenage caveman, directed and produced by Roger Corman. Now, Roger Corman had some real problems with the title of this film. Of course, the film was distributed here in the United States by American International Pictures. Of course, at the time, the founders, James H. Nicholson and Samuel Z. Arkoff, had been so impressed with the teenage approach to monster movies, especially with teenage Frankenstein and teenage werewolf, one that Samuel Z. Arkoff called a $70,000 picture with a million-dollar title, they loved the concept of making a film about a teenage caveman. But Roger Corman hated the title of the movie. We're going to tell you a little bit more about that as we get a little further on into the storyline. I want to warn some of you out there that have not seen this film, and there may be a few of you that have not seen it, that it would be better that you not listen to this podcast until you've had a chance to see it. Now, this film is easy to find. If you don't mind commercials, it's available on Roku and Tubi. In fact, I just saw one. I just saw the version on Roku a couple of nights ago. It is a wonderfully restored version of it. It's a little bit better quality than the Tubi one is. I think you can also find it on Pluto and Philo and some of those other, some of the other free streaming services. The only other one you can go to find it on is Amazon Prime. You're going to have to pay about $3 for it there. But if you don't mind commercials, which are not badly, spaced in this, then you can see it for free. Like I said, on the Roku channel, it's beautifully, beautifully restored. So anyway, I really think if you have not seen this movie or don't know anything about it, then you need to watch the movie before you listen to this podcast. I want to give you that opportunity because we will spoil everything about this movie. And this movie has a couple of twists and turns in it. I'm not even going to mention that too much because I don't want to give it away. This is an interesting little film. This is one of those movies that I had different views of depending upon the time in my life that I saw it. So anyway, give you a chance to go see the movie. As we pick it up now, 1958 black and white film by Roger Corman. And this was one that I caught on my Monster Movie Matinee show. I was probably around 9 years old when I saw it for the first time. I had not seen Teenage Werewolf yet. I saw this before Teenage Werewolf and Teenage Frankenstein, even though they're all made about the same year and released right around the same year. So was Blood of Dracula. They were all right within that 1957-1958 time period. And there was something about this film I really liked. Now, the film didn't get shown a lot that one time, and I don't recall seeing it again until I was in high school. And I think that was right after we moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. And then I didn't see it again. You know, so it just made some appearances here and there. But it was very, very hard to catch on the broadcast side. It did come out on a VHS, and it also came out on a DVD and Blu-ray. You can find it in all those formats now. But it was a long time before I saw this film again. And it was one of those situations where I got thinking, gee, you know, I haven't done the Teenage Caveman. Or actually, it's just called Teenage Caveman. Again, a title that Roger Corman absolutely hated. He produced the film under the title Prehistoric World. And the more we talk about this, I think you'll get the idea why he much preferred that to the title that it has. But there was something about this I couldn't remember why I liked this film so much as a kid. And I don't remember I remember seeing it in high school, and I don't remember having a real vivid reaction to it. But as a kid, I really liked this and kept looking for it, and it just wouldn't show up. I think maybe it might have shown up one time more. Before I was even in my teenage years, and then just sort of disappeared. But as I saw it as an adult, first time I saw it as an adult, then I remembered what it was that appealed to me about this movie. And it was more than about, a crazy movie about a teenage caveman amongst other cavemen and women and dinosaurs and things of that nature. Appealing only to people who think the Flintstones is a historical docudrama. Because it's pretty much acknowledged that humans, as we know them anyway, weren't around when the dinosaurs were around. Of course, I don't know, things change. You never know. We might find some evidence that some of that might have been true. But, in all of the movies that we grew up watching that would put men in with the dinosaurs and stuff, other than, films like Jurassic Park and all of that. I'm thinking specifically here, 1 million years BC, which has a relationship to this movie. Roger, as he was on a very short budget with this, $70,000. He was under directions by AIP to produce a historical drama. And in a sense, they did. We'll tell you more about that down the road. So he was trying to catch AIP in a loophole, but he really needed more money to make this work, because folks, I'm going to tell you right now, this actually, for what it is a pretty good movie. It's not bad. Roger liked it. He said he thought it was good, but he wished he'd had more money because he could have made it even better. One of the cast members and one of the main cast members, Robert Vaughn, who this film was centered around, he is the guy that carries this movie, hated the movie. He said it was the worst film he ever made. It was the worst film ever made, which I was about ready to say the worst film he ever made, but in his mind it was. He didn't like it at all, and he didn't think Roger Corman was a good director. He said he was just a director who tried to get in under budget. But I think as you look at this film more, and if you haven't seen it in a while, I am going to urge you to go back and see it again. It had been almost 30 years since I'd seen this film last. And I got to admit, it really, really got my attention a little bit more this last time around. Because of so much I'd forgotten about. It's one of those strange films that I'm surprised I didn't remember this better. It has a big hook at the end that turns it from being a ridiculous film to one that's, hey, it's not too bad. So let's visit some of the main people that we're going to see in Teenage Caveman. We talked about Robert Vaughn. What can we say about Robert Vaughn? For those of us in my generation, he will always be remembered for the television series Man from U.N.C.L.E. But he had quite an illustrious career. Big on stage, studied drama when he was in college. He floated around from a couple of different colleges. Because he left one college to go to Hollywood and then started studying drama there. And he actually has a PhD that he got from Southern California. So, quite an intelligent guy. He started out as a journalism major at the University of Minnesota, but he didn't like that. That's when he moved to Los Angeles with his mom and then studied theater arts at Los Angeles City College before transferring to the State College for Applied Arts and Sciences. And he got a master's degree there and then earned a PhD from the University of Southern California. And his dissertation, by the way, dealt with the House Committee on Un-American Activities and how it affected the American theater. Yeah. So very intelligent guy. So, and by this time, by the time he does this film, he's had quite a career in the theater, very good theater career, before he was picked up and started playing in films. But before he did this film, 2 years before he did Teenage Caveman, he appeared as an extra in Ten Commandments. Yeah. One of the extras in that. And then his first credited movie role occurred in Hell's Crossroads, 1957. Played Bob Ford. Yeah. One of the guys that murdered Jesse James. And Burt Lancaster saw him in a play, and Lancaster signed him to his film company. And he played the role of Steve Dallas in Sweet Smell of Success. Did a few other westerns as well before he got teamed up with Paul Newman in The Young Philadelphians, 1959, the year after he does Teenage Caveman. He scores a supporting role in The Young Philadelphians and was actually nominated for an Academy Award. He didn't win, but hey, not bad. Not bad at all. Also received was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for that one, for Best Supporting Actor as well. Then appeared in a lot of films, big films like The Magnificent Seven, Bullet. Of course, later on in his career in the 80s, we saw him in Superman 3, which wasn't one of the better Chris Reeves Superman films. I mean, there's something, I've watched it over and over many times. It was definitely one of the weaker ones of the series, but he played the bad guy in that one. They did a whole lot of television work throughout all of this. And of course, he did films galore. Films galore. I mean, Brass Target was one I remember him being in. And he would just show up in all kinds of movies. But a lot of television, Gunsmoke, Dick Van Dyke, The Lieutenant, but The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the Four Seasons, he was on that show as Napoleon Solo, is the one that will always be burned into our heads. For those of us who grew up in the 60s, that's what we think of when we think of Robert Vaughn. Now, he did appear on As the World Turns for a while and also in One Life to Live. So he did a little daytime television in the 60s. And there was a show that ran in 1998 for 2 years called The Magnificent Seven. You know, and I never saw that one, the TV series. Appeared in that, the episodes of that. So, I mean, he was all over the map. And then he started his own production company. He produced a couple of films through that as well. So, I mean, he was a man of many talents. And don't forget, in the 1970s, a British television series that was produced by his company that came over to the United States called The Protectors also starred Robert Vaughn. And we saw him on TV pitching different things. Quite a guy. But he was not too pleased with this film. Early enough in his career, didn't really hurt him. But no, he did have... anything good to say about Teenage Caveman. And maybe it was because he didn't quite understand it. I don't know. But we lost him a few years ago in 2016. He was 83 years old when he passed away. Quite a full career. Robert Vaughn. Now, the main female that we're going to see in this film is one that she's sort of fascinating. She didn't have much of a career. She was a beauty queen as a teenager, won a teenage Miss USA contest at the age of 17, got into film and only had seven credits. Started things off with an appearance on The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet on television. That led to her appearing here in Teenage Caveman as the blonde maiden opposite Robert Vaughn's character. And they actually become sort of a man and wife type. There isn't like a, well, there's sort of their version in their tribe, their clan, as it's called, their version of marriage. But several television appearances: Bachelor Father, King of Diamonds, Ripcord, Checkmate. In fact, a lot of the members of the cast here in Teenage Caveman appeared in those three shows: King of Diamonds, Ripcord, and Checkmate. And then she got married and got out of the business. And we lost her not too long ago in 2019. She was 85 years old. Very pretty gal, and you know, for what it was worth, for what the character was, how the character was written, Dara Marshall did pretty well. I should have mentioned that was her name, Dara Marshall. This would probably be her signature role, a supporting, you know, a co-starring role in a major production. Now, another familiar face you're going to see is Leslie Bradley. He plays Robert Vaughn's father. Now, you know, Robert Vaughn is supposed to be like a teenager just coming to adulthood, because there will be a scene in the film where he becomes a man, officially becomes a man according to their ceremonies. Leslie Bradley, born in 1907. He was born in England, came over here to the United States and did several films. The Crimson Pirate, Time Flies, but one that we as monster kids will always remember him for, and that was Attack of the Crab Monsters. But, I mean, he appeared in television and had jump-in roles in film all throughout the 50s and the 60s. He passed away in 1974, and his last appearance was in 1970 on the Young Rebels TV series. Done a few television appearances in the late 60s and up till 1970 before he retired. And just a really solid actor. You know, that was the one thing about Roger Corman. Roger Corman found actors who may not be well known or didn't have huge monster careers, but they were just reliable, good actors all the way around. Always amazes me the kind of people that he gets a hold of. And one more that I want to mention for you there'll be a couple more we're going to mention for you. But right now, I want to mention Frank Dacova. Yeah. Now, we will always remember Frank Dacova for F-Troop. Always. But, you know, he started out with a role in the Ten Commandments, and then he had some roles here and there all throughout in various motion pictures. 155 appearances on television and movies. He plays a guy that's sort of a troublemaker in this. Yeah, none of these people have names. So Frank Dacova is just known as the black bearded one because he's got a black beard. And he's a one, I guess. Oh, my goodness. Some of the other people you're going to see that are very, very familiar faces from this time period. Jonathan Hayes, who plays the curly-haired boy. Of course, Jonathan will always be remembered for a Roger Corman classic, Little Shop of Horrors. But he appeared in several Corman films. I mean, he was one of the regular Corman thespians, as they're known. And Beach Dickerson. This is a guy that's sort of fun. Beach gets to play three different people in this. He's the fair-haired boy. He's also the man from the Burning Plains, and he's the Tom player. He's got three different parts. So, you know Roger Corman. He always found a way to save a buck. And Beach was sort of interesting. Now, Beach, you know, almost exclusively worked with Roger Corman films. He got out at a fairly young age, and he got into real estate. Like, so, you know, we've talked about so many of these actors from the 40s and 50s got into real estate and was very, very successful. He ended up helping many big-time stars find their homes. And he's known more probably for people in California for that than for the Corman pictures. But, you know, again, he does a pretty good job on this. You know, all of the acting in this is decent, but I'm going to put a caveat there, depending upon your perspective. And that's what we're going to talk about here in just a second. Two other people you're going to recognize in this, Ed Nelson, who appeared in several Corman pictures, but it was always going to be known as Dr. Michael Rossi for Peyton Place, for the television show Peyton Place. That's the first time I remember seeing him. And then when I got into monster movies, it was like, oh, yeah, man, I remember this guy. Because as I've told you before, my mom was a huge fan of Peyton Place. And it was like one of the first, quote unquote, adult TV shows that I got to watch. And my cat loved it, too. I had a cat named Boots back then growing up. He was a gray tiger, a gray tabby tiger. Sweet as can be. He reminded me a lot of Scooter, the cat that I had up until a couple of years ago. And Boots knew the music to Peyton Place. And it was sort of funny that every time it came on TV, there he was. He come running into the living room and he was parked right there in front of the TV to watch Peyton Place. I think maybe it was because we all watched it. Now, my two sisters were too young to see. They were usually in bed by that time. But, you know, since I was the oldest, I got a chance to watch Peyton Place. It's the only soap opera, other than Dark Shadows, probably I ever got involved with. And last and certainly not least, Robert Shane. Here we go again. Yes, well, I had to have an Adventures of Superman connection here, as I do in just about every monster movie that I talk about. Of course, Robert Shane, Inspector Henderson. And he plays the Firemaker. You've got three wise men in the clan that Robert Vaughn is a member of. One of them's the Firemaker. And then one is a man who has a wheel, the Wheelmaker. And then the other one is one that we never really get identified. I'm really not sure what he is. but you have Leslie Bradley playing the cymbal maker. And Robert Vaughn, of course, is the cymbal maker's son. The cymbal maker will go in every year and paint cymbals on the cave. And he sort of, you know, it's implied that he uses these cymbals. He has, you know, there's a quick conversation we see in the film between the cymbal maker and his son, where the son says, "Why do we do the cymbals every year for this annual ceremony?" He goes, "Because we have the skill. We were born with the skill to do it." And it's more, and there's a little more implied there, like maybe he has a vision of things to come, a little bit of a vision of things to come that the others might not have. Now, we very quickly see in this motion picture that Robert Vaughn's character as the cymbal maker's teenage son is very intelligent, and he thinks out of the box. The clan is living in this fairly barren area around these caves. They live in the caves for safety. But there's a conversation between the cymbal maker and his son about a nearby river that their law tells them they cannot cross. We're not really sure where the law came from, except, you know, one of the elder tribesmen from many, many years back, someone who is long gone now, but who established the law that no one in the clan would be allowed to cross the river that's nearby. And there's a tale of a god that lives across the river whose touch is deadly, so that anyone crossing the river would be punished by this god with their death. Just a simple touch would kill them. We also find out that there's an artifact that's kept in the cave by the ancient ones, by the elders. And of course, we have a sort of a clan head, clan president, whatever you would call him, who reveals to the symbol maker's son, when he becomes a man, an artifact that will kill you if you touch it. It's an artifact that fell from the sky in a ball of flame. You know, almost, you know, you make think volcano maybe, but you're not allowed to touch it. You can only glance at it from a distance, and it's kept covered. So you've got Robert Vaughn's character, this teenage caveman, and he's asking his father. He says, why can't we cross that river? Now we know there's dinosaurs over there because they can see them from a distance. This is where 10 million years BC, not the one with Raquel Welch, because that came out in the 60s, but the one that was made before this. That's where we see our dinosaurs from, you know, sort of roaming around in the distance, all over the place. Corman was able to get a lot of stock footage from that film. So, you know, the distance dinosaurs look fine. Some of the close-up ones, of people walking around in suits. Dude, you remember when we did the Unknown Island? Yeah, it's, you know, it looks like that, you know, those kind of suits. So, you know, the symbol maker, Leslie Bradley's character, he says, we might get killed with the animals. And of course, you know, Robert Vaughn's character just doesn't buy, because he says, look, the land over there is filled with plants. There's animals over there. We could get enough food to last us a lifetime if we could hunt there, because there's not a whole lot to get here. You know, it's very rocky here, fairly barren. They can get an elk here and there, but, you know, food is at a premium. And he just can't figure out why it's against the law. Now, I'm going to take a little break here and talk about three very important people that are a part of this movie. The movie was written by R. Wright Campbell, screenwriter. He was an author. He occasionally would act, not very much. He was the brother of William Campbell, who was a big actor, and one that we've talked about quite a bit here on Monster Attack. He began writing for Hollywood way, way back, and became, through his brother William, you know, William Campbell was a big Roger Corman thespian, who also did a lot of TV work. But that's how Robert Wright got a job writing, and he started writing for Roger Corman. First film he wrote for him was Five Guns West, and wrote a ton of scripts, not only for Roger Corman, but for other big-time stars as well. A couple of novels, and was just a very accomplished screenwriter. Passed away in 2000, the age of 73, but just well-known by all of the folks in Hollywood for the television episodes that he wrote. He wrote for three series, television series, almost exclusively. And the films that he wrote. And he writes this is an intriguing script. I'm not going to be too negative on this script. And again, I'm saying that with a caveat, because It's a matter of perspective. And I know you're going to say, what is Jim talking about on this? This is a film that got made fun of by Mystery Science Theater 3000. Yeah. Okay. Well, I can understand why they did, but I'm going to tell you why this isn't a bad film. Now, the next guy I want to mention is Floyd Crosby. Floyd Crosby was an Academy Award winner for his cinematography, did a bunch of huge films. I don't even have time to tell you all the films that he did, but he did several for Roger Corman, like The Pit and the Pendulum and The Raven, Man with the X-Ray Eyes. When we talked about these Corman films, remember, one of the big things about them that were so good was the cinematography. And I got to hand it to him, folks. Even though some of this doesn't match up well with the stock footage, I mean, the stock footage is, you know, many years old. The footage that he shoots here of the Klan and stuff is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So no, I have no issue with the way this film looks. By the way, Floyd is probably also well known for one of his children by the name of David. Yeah. David Crosby, that David Crosby, Crosby, Sills, Nash & Young. So he had just some good genes passed down in his family. And speaking of music, it's a great segue into our third guy that I wanted to talk about. That's Albert Glazer. He wrote the music for this. And the music is going to sound very familiar because Albert Glazer did music for, again, 200 films during his career, and many of them for American International Pictures and director Bird Eye Gordon. And you're gonna know that when you hear the music in this film, it's like it's not exactly the same that you might have heard in a Bird Eye Gordon, some of the Bird Eye Gordon films, most specifically The Amazing Colossal Man and War of the Colossal Beast, or The Cyclops, or Monster from Green Hell, or The Neanderthal Man, or Invasion USA. You know, when you watch all those movies, it's like, yeah, the guy who did the music is the same guy. So you may not know his name. His name is Albert Glazer. He passed away in 1998 at the age of 82. Had a long, long career that spanned almost 50 years. And, you know, the music in this is the typical 50s type music we've heard in monster movies. A lot of horns. Good beat, but it doesn't detract from the movie. It enhances the movie like music should. So now we'll get back to our story. So we've got some good elements putting together here. For $70,000, Roger's got some pretty good elements coming together here. You know, decent actors, you know, a decent collection of new and veteran actors. Of course, Robert Vaughn, again, is an up-and-coming actor. Had already made quite a name for himself early on in his career at this point. So here he is playing this teenage caveman. I guess I'll call him the teenage caveman from here on out, or the title character. It'd be so much easier to do this if these people actually had names. Oh, and they all speak English. So when you watch this for the first time, and there may be some people that said, I'm just going to listen to the podcast and see what you have to say about this. They all speak English. Now, as a kid, when I was 9 years old, I didn't care about that. No, I didn't. You know, because so many of the films back then, if there were science fictions where we went to another planet, everybody spoke English. No explanation. They just did. Now, as I got older, when I got into high school, it's like, yeah, you know, that's sort of, you know, I don't know about this. But there's something that's going to make you change your mind on that. I'll tell you that. The big surprise at the end. So everybody's speaking English. They're almost speaking it. You know, when Roger did films like The Undead and then some of his period pieces where people almost delivered their lines in sort of a Shakespearean type delivery, that's exaggerating it a little bit, but you know what I mean? Sort of a more pronounced type delivery. That's how the lines are delivered in this movie, like that. And a lot of people had some real problems with that. So I just wanted to mention that. Keep that in mind as we tell you what's going on in here. Teenage caveman, he becomes a man after being punished for going across the river. Yeah, he took some guys with him. He got a few of the younger men, said, we're going to go over there and hunt. But it's illegal, you know. And here's where I call Frank Dacova's character, the black bearded one, sort of a troublemaker, because he's edged him on early in the movie saying, well, you know, and he walks with a pronounced limp. He says, if it was me, my legs weren't so bad, I'd go do it. Yeah, somebody could go over there and, you know, find out what's going on, why it is, you know, against our laws or something. Maybe we need new laws and all that. And you're really stirring them up. And so Robert Vaughn's character takes Jonathan Hayes and Beach Dickerson and Ed Nelson along with him. A couple of the other, I should say, boys from the Klan. And they make it over there and they see monsters of all kinds. You know, the big dinosaurs and all of that. And then they have a run-in with the god. The one that everyone's talking about. If it touches you, it will kill you. And the others run off. Now, the teenage caveman, he stays. He holds it off with a torch. He's able to keep it at bay. But the others run off. And on the way, trying to get back to where the clan is, Beach Dickerson's character, the fair-haired boy, he encounters something that everybody encounters in every jungle movie ever made. Okay, those of you longtime listeners, how many of you have your hands up? Do you know what it is? We see it in every jungle movie ever made. No, it's not an animal. It's quicksand. Quicksand! Oh my God, there's quicksand here! But they call it the ground that sinks, the sinking ground. Even though we really don't see it, like it doesn't look like quicksand. He sort of falls into the water of the river, and then you know we understand that he's caught on the bottom. His head's still above water, but he's being sucked in. They try to save him, and he's gone. They lose him. So the fair-haired boy is gone, and that frees him up to play two other people in this play. And you don't realize it's him. I mean, the makeup is good enough where you don't realize it's Beach Dickerson playing the same character. I mean, another character over and over again in the movie. So the guys run back, and then Vaughn finally does, teenage gay man. He makes it back. And who raises an issue about it? Of course, the black-bearded one played by Frank Dacova. How can this man do this again? How can he do it again? You know, he's broken the law. He's done it twice. This was the second time he's done it. And so they shun him, which makes it a little hard for him to have a romance with Dara Marshall, his blonde maiden. But they managed to sneak away and do that here and there. And then finally, he does win his favor back. And he has his celebration of reaching manhood. And during that, he's asked, will you obey the law? Will you follow the law and all that? And do what the clan tells you to do. And he says yes to both, even though the bearded one gets him off to the side afterwards and goes, you didn't sound like you were being very honest there. He's still obsessed with crossing the river and showing how good the hunting would be over there. Because you see that when he went over there with the other guys, they came back with nothing because of the problems they ran into. So he goes off on his own. I'm going to cut to the chase here real quick. He goes over there on his own, and his father asks his mother, where's the boy? Oh, and by the way, she's played by June Jocelyn. She's going to be another person that you recognize from Corman films. Pretty much exclusively Corman films. Didn't have a long career, but, a few films here and there. She was also in the Ten Commandments, but she did a lot of Burt I. Gordon films. She did The Amazing Colossal Man. She appears a short appearance in that, and The Spider, or Earth versus the Spider. 21 credits. She last appeared on an episode of I Dream of Jeannie in 1969. So, a little TV here and there and then these movies. Attack of the Puppet People. She was also in Attack of the Puppet People. I don't want to forget that one. She was the gal who led the gals, the little brawny gals, in the beginning of that movie that we talked about to see the doll factory. And then she got out of the business and settled down, raised a family. And we lost her a few years ago as well. And she says the boys cross the river. So father takes off, the cymbal maker, he takes off after the boy. And then, of course, our black-bearded one gets all, all he wants is power in the clan. It's very, very, obvious that that's what he wants. So he gets up a gang and he says, we've got to go get them. We've got to save them from themselves. And they all take off. And this is where they run up on the god. Okay, we're getting to the big climax at the end. It's funny, folks. The podcast is going to be almost as long as the movie is itself, because there was a lot to talk about on this. But they meet the god, this weird thing. Now, it looks very familiar. It's a suit that Corman has used in another film. You'll recognize it. Weird-looking suit. Very, very strange. And, of course, does it come to as any surprise that it's a costume made by Paul Blaisdell? It's one of his. So it's got that signature mark to it. And we all loved Paul Blaisdell's monsters. They were, even though it would have been great to have seen him have a bigger budget to see what he could come up with, they were always clever. Well, during this confrontation, the symbol maker's son Robert Vaughn realizes, he says, wait a minute, this creature's not trying to hurt us. We can communicate with it, because they're all back at a distance. And he throws down his little bow and arrow, which he's made. Actually, you know, this is one thing that suggests that he's a little more intelligent than the rest, because he came up with the idea of a bow and arrow as opposed to just a spear, just a lance. Found that very effective. But he doesn't throw it down, but he holds it off to the side, holds his hands up to show this creature that he means him no harm. And he says, we mean you no harm. And the creature's sort of responding. But while this is going on, the black bearded one, oh, here he is. He's gone around to the side. He's climbed up in a tree, taken the high ground, gets a big rock and throws it down on the creature and kills it, which does not sit well with Robert Vaughn's character, because he said, we were making contact. And when they get up there, they realize that it's a man. Now, earlier in the movie, we had seen a man show up out of somewhere riding a horse, which they didn't know what a horse was. And they killed him. And the horse ran off because he was coming from the evil place, the place that's prohibited. And the black bearded one, again, made trouble there. Said, no, we have to kill him because he'd bring the evil into us. Oh, this guy. Well, when they get up to the monster, they realize that this burned skin and stuff that it looks like he's got, isn't that? It's a strange material. And he's wearing like a hood. And they pull it off and it's an old man in this suit. And while they're exploring some more, and now they're touching the guy and they're not dying, they find a book. They don't know what it is, but Robert Vaughn's character opens it up. He says, what are these symbols? You know, I'm the symbol maker's son. I don't recognize this. And nobody does. Nobody recognizes it. His father doesn't recognize it. And it has pictures. They have no idea what that is. But now we do, because we see pictures of a society and mention of a nuclear war. Yes, folks. You wondered if I was going to bring that into this. This is a 1958 picture. And you probably thought, hey, you know, Jim's going to get all the way through this and not have to mention the fear of nuclear war. But that's exactly what this is all about. These people were the survivors. This clan was the survivors of a nuclear holocaust. And this god and the other man were scientists. And this weird burned out skin that we saw on this guy was the remainder, what was left, I should say, of his radiation suit. As we hear in the narration, which is done by Robert Shane, that they lived a lot longer than they thought they should have after their exposure to the radiation of this nuclear holocaust. That's why they would kill the Klan members if they touched him. But at this point, radiation had finally gotten, you know, down to levels that were all right, where their touch wouldn't hurt anybody. Which probably means that this artifact that they weren't allowed to touch probably wouldn't have killed them to touch it either. So we find out, as the film ends, they've got this book. They're going to try to make some sense out of it down the road. As they walk back to their caves, realizing now they've got this whole ground open that they can hunt. Animals that they can hunt for skins and meat. You know, a lush ground, maybe even move to. They can, you know, find places that will be safe from the big dinosaurs. And the conjecture that one society got so far that they destroyed themselves. Here we've seen in this clan that whenever these guys didn't understand something, they wanted to kill it because they thought it was evil. So the makings are there that maybe they'll do it again and repeat history. So looking at it that way, folks, now when you go back and look at this film, it explains why they speak English. It explains why they look like they do, because, you know, the one thing I noticed about, you know, Robert Vaughn's character had perfectly coiffed hair. I didn't even comment on that. And so did all the women. And why the script is written the way it is. Because these were the descendants of an intelligent society. More than likely, it's implied, ours. The pictures were of scenes seen around the United States and Europe, Asia, and talking about nuclear power. And the nuclear bombs. And so it ends up being a pretty good comment on how we need to be careful. What we've got, and we're going to end up like that. You know, and it goes back to what Albert Einstein said. Now, Albert Einstein said, I don't know what weapons they will use to fight World War III, but I do know what they'll use to fight World War IV. Sticks and stones. And that's what this movie, that's the lesson learned in this movie. And there were some critics when it came out in 1958 who said, you know, he had the right idea. One of them said if he'd had a bigger budget, it would have been a really great film. You know, it would have been a Planet of the Apes type film. Well, they didn't say that, but I'm saying that. I could have easily seen that if they'd given Roger a huge budget on this. So that's why I say it's all in your perspective. This is actually a pretty good film, folks. Not a great film. Even Roger will tell you that. But it's not as dopey as you would think it would be. And Roger, to this day, thought that the title that Arkoff and Nicholson made him put on this film, or what they put on the film, he didn't have any, he didn't have to put it on there. In fact, if you were to ask Roger Corman today, what about, you know, directing Teenage Caveman, he will tell you, I didn't direct a film called Teenage Caveman. I directed a film called Prehistoric World, and he felt that really hurt the film. It was marketed all wrong. So people came in with preconceived notions, so they didn't understand what it was all about. So, folks, I'm going to give you a thumbs up on this one. Check it out. It's an interesting period piece from 1958 and a unique way of dealing with our fear of nuclear war, nuclear bombs, and weapons. And I think it's well worth a look. And I know they made their $70,000 back. It got a lot of showings and drive-ins in smaller theaters. And, of course, with VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, and all of that now, and it's on streaming services now, they've made a lot of money back. So it did well overall. I can't give you the exact numbers. They weren't available. But Teenage Caveman, we'll add it to our teenage list, along with Werewolf, Frankenstein, Blood of Dracula, and Teenage Caveman. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next Monday for an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Hey, folks, you have a great week, and we will see you then.
Ask yourself, is the Flopcast the right podcast for you?
Do you have trouble picking a favorite Weird Al song, Karate Kid sequel, or Justice League Detroit member? Are you obsessed with Cousin Oliver from the Brady Bunch, Vicky the Captain's daughter from the Love Boat,
or Vicky the robot from Small Wonder?
Do you think Cyndi Lauper's We Are the World solo is the most important event in history?
You have half an hour a week for something completely stupid.
Then the Flopcast might be the right podcast for you.
We're on the ESO Network
and at flopcast.net.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.